We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
So first up, I have to apologize for the dead air last week. Somehow I had gotten into my head that I was going to be able to do a live show from the Dallas Makerspace while presenting the Nuclear Science Day event there. This was a miscalculation on my part. I was too busy talking to people. Now, I'd like to say that I was too busy talking to people because of all the eager people who showed up for the Nuclear Science Day event. In practice, it's a little more complicated than that because I was in the front lobby at the Makerspace, so people coming in and out were all passing by me, but quite a number of them stopped to talk and look at the exhibit and
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello? I don't know what that was about. That was odd. Anyway, so the big number of people who were actually there were people coming for some kind of retro computing event. And I was a bit sorry that it conflicted with the Nuclear Science Day event, because if it hadn't, I might have brought I've got this Mac 128 that belonged to my late grandfather, which Mom says she wants me to sell, you know, for the benefit of the estate. Anyway, it's got all the accessories and things, so I need to find a retro computing meetup where there might be somebody to buy it. But that's irrelevant. What is relevant? Well, as I say, several of the people who were there for the retro computing event did stop to talk. Several of them had actually come up from Austin. And one person in particular described how he had spent the summer, sometime around 1980, working for Viscount Ilya Prigozhin, who was at the University of Texas in Austin at that time, studying tokamak noise. So it's funny, you will not find either of them listed on the Wikipedia page about tokamaks, but where there's what's supposed to be an extensive list of tokamaks. But the University of Texas did have, in downtown Austin, a tokamak from the late 1960s to the early 1990s. First, the original Texas tokamak, also known as the Texas Turbulent Taurus. And then after that, the Texas Experimental Tokamak, also known as TEXT. I think this person must have been working on the second one. The first one was taken out in the late 70s to be replaced with the second one. Anyway, the topic of the research was tokamak noise, which is a particular phenomenon which occurs in this type of reactor. And Prigozhin thought that by taking very high-speed photographs, the person I was talking to described how they used explosive bolts to open and close the shutters over the quartz portholes in the reactor in order to get very fast exposures on the film and not have a lot of like radiation leakage and so on from the reactor. The idea was to study this in the hopes of obtaining information that would allow building a mathematical model of this particular kind of plasma instability. So, unfortunately, apparently, between the film grain and other things, they just couldn't get enough good quality data to develop a mathematical model of the phenomenon. But it was apparently quite an interesting piece of research anyway. interesting way to spend a summer, you know, getting your fellowship money. So that's basically what I have to report from the Nuclear Science Day at DMS. Now, I'm going to upload a substitute show. Now, obviously, you won't normally hear it unless there's a repeat for some reason. But I am going to upload a substitute show, and I will put a link to that substitute show on the Step Farther Out page on the AnonRadio.net website. So if you go to the AnonRadio.net website, there is a page for A Step Farther Out. And that has a list of not only the regular Saturday shows, but also the call-in live reading shows that I have done some of in the last couple of months in Tuesdays and Fridays time slot, which is normally for my other show, Hear Now the Words. Yesterday I actually went and did some archive maintenance because some of those live call-ins, for whatever reason, the archive bot did not cut off at the end of the hour or something, with the result that in addition to the hour of me talking, there was also a bunch of extra stuff on the end, which was, you know, your Anon Radio Auto DJ and that kind of thing, which doesn't really belong with it. So I uploaded new versions of those archive files, and I believe that the archives have been updated. Now, what is that substitute show going to be about? What's the topic that I am going to, that you will hear about if you listen to the substitute show? Well, the answer is research reactors. After all, my previous show, I was talking enthusiastically about my visit to the research reactor at Garching, north of Munich. And so I thought I would take some time to just talk about research reactors, because research reactors are a really fascinating topic. The very, very short form of the substitute show, the content of the substitute show, is this. There are three broad categories of nuclear fission chain reactors: research reactors, production reactors, and power reactors. Production reactors are very much alike. Power reactors are largely alike because they all have the same purpose, even if they get there by somewhat different ways. Research reactors are immensely diverse because they have lots of different purposes. So, that's the short form, and so if you want to listen to a half hour of me talking about the different kinds of research reactors, what their purposes are, how they get there, then that will be an opportunity for that. Anyway, but now moving on to the current events portion of our show today. Now, a portion of what I'm going to talk about comes out of the Wall Street Journal. I detest the Wall Street Journal. I can't stand it. But that's largely because of its editorial viewpoint and the way that the people who write for the Wall Street Journal think about the world. I find it disturbing in the extreme. But there's often useful information in it. So I do glance at it from time to time, and when I do, I often find something of interest. It's just hard to cope with, even worse than conventional newspapers. I just find a lot of people who write for newspapers, I mean other media outlets similarly, have very little sense of perspective. I guess that's the best way of describing it. Anyway, but as you may have heard by now, it looks like Germany for the next few years is very likely to be governed by a coalition of the SPD, the Greens, and the FDP. Now, these are not three parties that are really comfortable together. SPD is center-left. The Greens are the Greens. The FDP is sort of a pro-business party. As I mentioned a couple of weeks back about my visit to Augsburg, The FDP at their campaign stands was handing out disposable, that is to say, non-refillable, single-use butane lighters made out of plastic. So you get the impression that they're pretty much the opposite of the Greens. So how they're going to be coalition partners, I'm not clear on. But that's the wacky world of politics. Now, the SPD is generally referred to as a center-left party. For a long time, one of the major differences between the SPD and the CSU-CDU, which you get, whether you get CSU or CDU is different depending on whether you're in Bavaria or the rest of Germany, but they work together as a single entity for most purposes. A main difference between the SPD, which is supposed to be center-left, and the CSU-CDU, which is supposed to be center-right, is that the SPD was the party with the anti-nuclear position. Originally, it appears that a major reason for this was that they were promoting domestic coal as an energy source to create jobs, which is really a misunderstanding of the function of energy supply in the economy. The fact is, energy is the thing that makes other kinds of economic activity, this actual useful stuff, possible. Creating jobs in energy is not a good idea. The less of your economic activity devoted to energy supply, the same as with basic agriculture, the less of your economic activity which is devoted to it, the more people have a chance to do something with their lives. You know, the only reason that, you know, Texas, you know, jobs in the oil patch are a big deal generally because they're well paid, not because there's something specially good about them. And so saying, oh, well, we're going to retrain all those people as solar panel installers. Well, solar panel installers, by the very nature of the thing, aren't well paid. So, you know, using wind and solar means that you have to devote a large portion of your economic activity to just providing the energy supply, which is basic for all other forms of economic activity. It becomes kind of a self-eating pancake pretty rapidly. So as I say, I think that the idea of domestic coal as a way to create jobs is a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of energy supply in the economy, and that has carried on into the renewable energy conversation. Basic misunderstanding. The Greens, of course, are just anti-nuclear, period. That's the one position they're not willing to give up. The FDP, nominally pro-nuclear these days, in the past anti-nuclear again on the same basis as the SPD, basically creating domestic jobs. The SPD's opposition to nuclear energy, I think, also probably had something to do with their desire for rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Again, this point I keep making that in very few countries, maybe only Sweden, has there ever been an open public debate about nuclear weapons. And so, absent that, in West Germany, where the NATO, basically the U.S., was deploying nuclear weapons, East Germany, where the Soviet Union was deploying nuclear weapons, nobody had a say about that, right? There was no open political debate about that. And so people's feelings about this nuclear weapons that they were not able to have a public debate about got in some degree transferred, I think, to nuclear power, which was the subject of public debate. And so the SPD was more interested in rapprochement with the Soviets, and the CSU-CDU was more interested in confrontation with the Soviets. And so that carried forward into their attitudes about nuclear energy for civil purposes, I think. It's a difficult thing to be sure of, but, you know, I look at cases. I look, for example, Helen Caldicott, one of the prophets of the anti-nuclear movement, who is notorious for saying a bunch of things that make no sense whatsoever. For example, that it's more environmentally friendly to read by candlelight than by electric light. Or that nobody ever needs air conditioning because you can't die of heat stroke. The woman was a medical doctor educated in Australia. People die of heat stroke all the time in Australia. She's also claimed that 2/3 of all cancers are caused by man-made radiation, and the remaining third by artificial natural radiation, which again makes no sense, and nobody in the field of oncology or cancer research would believe that for a moment. But again, she was a pediatrician from Australia. She moved to Britain in the 70s. She became involved with a group called Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is nominally against nuclear war, but did a lot of anti-nuclear power campaigning. In particular, she was in the forefront of a campaign to convince the British government, basically saying, don't build new nuclear ballistic missile submarines. Use that money on the National Health Service instead, which I think is a perfectly reasonable political position to take. But somehow that mutated, again, only form of radiation mutation I've ever seen happen in a human being, mutated into a hostility towards civil nuclear energy. All very strange, if you ask me, considering that, of course, medical people who've actually studied the question, notably Maurice Toubiana, the great French authority on the question, will tell you that the effects on human life and health throughout the whole fuel cycle of nuclear energy, the negative effects are far smaller than those of fossil fuel energy, and the positive effects are, if anything, greater. Because, of course, there are substantial positive effects. You know, there's a great chart that I use, a slide that I use in my Introduction to Atomic Energy talks, for example, that I was giving for Nuclear Science Week, which shows the average person's exposure to ionizing radiation. And the way it works out is about 2/3 of it is natural radiation, which comes to cosmic radiation and terrestrial radiation and radioactivity in the food you eat. You know, it's not just bananas. As I've remarked before, there's uranium in phosphate fertilizer. The United States government used to pay phosphate fertilizer companies to separate that uranium out. But at present, the world price of uranium isn't high enough to pay them to do it, and the government doesn't pay them to do it, so it goes into your food instead. So if you want less radioactivity in your food, go for nuclear power. That'll give people a reason to separate out the uranium. I mean, that's a real fact. That's not, you know, that's not hand-waving. That's a genuine fact. Lower levels of radioactivity in your food as a result of more demand for uranium for nuclear fuel. Crazy, huh? But that's the way life is. Anyway, about 1/3 of the chunk is medical exposure, and then less than 1%, in fact, more like 0.1%, is all man-made sources, including fallout from nuclear weapons tests, which is still a bigger chunk than nuclear energy activities, even rolling in Chernobyl and Fukushima. You might find that interesting. You know, 50 years after, well, almost 65 years now since, now I'm getting snarled up. No, 55 years now since the United States and Soviet Union stopped atmospheric nuclear testing, although, of course, France and China did continue on. Anyway, but that's not my point. The point was the remaining, that 1/3 that comes from medical exposure, well, that's for people in wealthy countries. And it's an average because it rolls in not only x-rays and CAT scans and so on that you get in the course of diagnostic, it also averages in the one person in 50 or whoever who gets radiation therapy for cancer or some other disease, who of course accumulates a much larger dose. Anyway, so the average for people in wealthy countries is substantially higher than for people in poorer countries, not because there are more nuclear power plants, but because they're more likely to get x-rays, CT scans, isotope studies, and radiation therapy in case of certain kinds of diseases. Well, of course, if radiation were the big killer, then you'd think people in wealthy countries would live shorter lives than people in poorer countries because of all that extra radiation they get. But, of course, in practice, we see it's the opposite way around. Anyway, so that is the so that is a thing. Honestly, that's a rant which is connected to almost nothing. But that was me talking about the anti-nuclear movement, I guess. I sorry, I sometimes I get on a roll and get completely off of my usual, completely off of the subject that I wanted to talk about. So what was the subject I wanted to talk about? Well, I was talking about the news. I was talking about the German political coalition, which is forming a government. Remember, the guy that who's going to be the head of the coalition government, the chancellor, this is a guy called Olaf Scholz. Now, the thing about Olaf Scholz is he's known as the Scholzomat. He is regarded as having no personality whatsoever and as being unlike most politicians, and he will give you a straight answer because he doesn't care. He's regarded as somewhat mechanistic as a person. And so people in Germany kind of trust this Scholz guy because he seems, like I say, they think he seems more like a computer or a cash register or something than a human being, which is a weird idea, and it does have unpleasant resonances with old incorruptible himself, Maximilian Robespierre, but that's neither here nor there. The point is that Scholz has publicly stated in the past that the German Energiewende, the energy transition, will require electricity rationing. We have to assume that people heard that message and accepted it, that they have, or at least they think they have, already accepted the reality of electricity rationing, because it's happening this winter, pretty much guaranteed. Why? Well, at the end of September in Germany, the natural gas storage reservoirs are supposed to be full. They were practically empty. If they're going to turn off half of the roughly 8 gigawatts of nuclear power capacity in the country, if they're going to turn that off on December 31st, you know, they're not going to be able to make up for the deficit in electric generation, which is already existing, with natural gas because they haven't got any. Right? What gas they can get is going to be dedicated for heating. There's going to be people being cold, and there's going to be power cuts. You know, that slogan that they used, the pro-nuclear campaigners used in Germany in the 80s, Atomkraft gegner überwintern bei Dunkelheit mit kaltem Hintern. People who oppose nuclear energy spend the winter in darkness with cold behinds. Well, this is a real thing. This is probably going to happen in Germany this winter. And so it's an interesting question. People think that they're prepared for power rationing, right? They've voted for Scholz. They trust Scholz to tell them the straight dope. Scholz has said that there will be power rationing. People think they're prepared for power rationing. Let's see what actually happens. Are there going to be power riots? I don't know. But the balance of probabilities is people are going to be cold and they're going to be in the dark. And they're not going to like it because nobody likes that. It makes me want to make a television commercial. It makes me want to go to Budějovice, which is otherwise mostly known as being the home of Budweiser beer. You know, in the United States, Budweiser is a trademark of Anheuser-Busch, but elsewhere in the world, it refers to beer from Budějovice in the Czech Republic. Now, Budějovice, aside from having a brewery, since 2019 has had another mark of distinction. The Temelin nuclear power plant, which is not terribly far away, they ran a pressurized hot water pipeline to Budějovice to supply the municipal heating system there. So this saved something like 70,000 tons of coal a year and improved the air quality in Budějovice. So what I really want to do, I want to make a television commercial. And I want to start in an apartment in Budějovice. I want you to see the family, you know, mom and dad and kids, and they've got electric lights up twinkling on the Christmas tree. They've got the electric train set up running around the floor. They've got the lights on. It's all very obviously very warm and cozy. You go into the kitchen. There's pots bubbling on the electric stove. You look at there's a turkey or a ham or a joint of beef or something in the electric oven. Everybody, you know, there's a warm glow of the red heating elements. You know, everybody's happy and warm. And then you go out of the apartment through the snow-covered landscape through the town. You go to the municipal heating station, where that's no longer burning coal, and things are neat and tidy looking because there's not a bunch of coal dust all over the place and all that garbage. And then you follow the hot water pipeline, right, through the snow-covered countryside to the nuclear power station, and it's a pretty neat and tidy looking nuclear power station. You have all the people working at their jobs in the warm, right? And And then we fade out to a title card that says Nuclear Winter. Yeah, I'm kind of savage like that, I admit. I don't pull punches. But I still, by the way, haven't found out from the Budvar Brewery whether or not they use heat from the municipal system to make their beer, to heat their brewing vats. I really want to know that. I want to know if this is atomic-powered beer. I really want to know that. And I haven't been able to find it out yet. But I'm going to keep asking them until I do find out. Now, another thing that I'd love to do in that line, by the way, I've actually asked my friends who live in northern Nevada to keep an eye out for billboards that say this billboard for rent and take down the information, because I have this horrible idea of putting up a billboard out in the middle of absolutely nowhere in Nevada, which says Pyramid Lake Atomic Power Station Visitor Center. Pyramid Lake Atomic Power Station Visitor Center, Sutcliffe, Nevada. Of course, there is no such thing as Pyramid Lake Atomic Power Station, but it would be hilarious to have people show up in Sutcliffe, a town which is just big enough for a convenience store, and ask about it. Because, of course, I have this whole thing about how the Paiute tribe, it's, you know, Pyramid Lake is the centerpiece of the Paiute Indian Reservation. It's got two towns, Sutcliffe and Nixon, neither of which even get their mail delivered there. They're considered part of Reno by the Postal Service, and Reno is like 200 kilometers away. That's pathetic, okay? But Sutcliffe and Nixon, Nevada. But the thing is, Pyramid Lake, the main moneymaker for the Paiutes is the people who come there to fish. Now, Pyramid Lake could be used as a source of cooling water for a nuclear power station. And if we say we give the Paiutes a 20% share in the station because it's on their land, and then they can use that 20% of the electricity, either they can use it for their own purposes or they can sell it, more likely to sell it. Then the other 80% is put up by the commercial utilities and public power districts and whatever, and they each get power as a share of their investment, which is typical, for example, of how the nuclear power stations in Finland are financed. Anyway, so the Paiute tribe gets a bunch of electricity so that they can sell it or else use it for their own purposes. They also get the hot water from the reactor, which they can use to heat not only their homes and community buildings, but also the fishing cabins, right? This is the great thing. And then a further advantage is we get the Bureau of Reclamation to stop diverting water at Derby Dam so that they get more water flow into Pyramid Lake. The lake rises. This is good for the population of the cutthroat trout, which is what people come there to fish for, right? Because, of course, we can say, oh, we need this water to cool the nuclear power station. It's important. It's right? And so the Pyramid Lake gets more water. This is important, right? It supports the population of the cutthroat trout, which is, again, the main business that brings in money for the Paiute folks. So they're suddenly way better off economically. And also, the other thing is, they're 20% owners of the plant. We also have guarantees that their people will be employed, not just in construction, but in the plant, which means we have to have education programs, right? Set up distance learning programs for the universities so they can have nuclear engineering school, right? They can have not only nuclear technologists, but even nuclear engineers from their community. And it suddenly gives them a huge leg up. Now, maybe I'm insane for thinking that the United States should be looking to site nuclear power plants on Indian reservations, making a deal with the various Indian nations so that they get the maximum possible benefit out of it. But the truth is, this is a way that we could help to redress a historic injustice, right? Because the thing is that the Native American peoples have been oppressed, in some cases exterminated, but they've been oppressed, they've been left out of the benefits of modern society. And in fact, many Native American people feel very badly towards nuclear.
7.